And there's at least a dozen substantial intrusions that show this crystallization sequence to varying degrees. The two intrusions that we're going to focus on as far as the mineralization goes are the Partridge River intrusion up here and the South Kuishui intrusion along the northwest margin of the complex. Finally, we get higher up in the sequence and we have intrusions that were placed higher in the volcanic pile. Most of the Duluth complex intruded along the base of the pile, intrusions within intrusions. Over time, things built higher up. Generally, we have younger ages. Instead of 1099 ages for the layered series, we have 1096 for Beaver Bay complex intrusion. And this is a very complicated area of intrusions within intrusions. It's more dike and sill types of intrusions, but there's granites. There's the Finland granite here and layered intrusions as well. Here's the Sanju Lake intrusion, a big dike and sill swarm here down by Beaver Bay. This is actually Beaver Bay is situated right here. Silver Bay is right here. And this is the area around Teteguch. You'll notice when you drive up the shore, all of a sudden you get past Split Rock Lighthouse, and the topography starts becoming more rugged. You've just entered the Beaver Bay complex. Intrusions are resistant relative to the volcanic flows just by the density of fractures in the rocks. And you can see that portrayed. Here's a grayscale image of the topography. And the brown here are intrusions. The green are basalt flows. And the pink are the big sheets of rhyolite flows that hold up things like Palisade Head and Shovel Point. So they're resistant because they're siliceous. Silica is a resistant mineral. It holds up high ground. So this is what gives rise to this very rugged topography you always notice when you're driving up the shore. The thing I want to note here, this brown unit here, this sort of network of intrusions is shown in brown. This is the Beaver River Diabase. It's renowned for having these large anorthosite inclusions. And here we're talking pure plagioclase rock, 95% plus plagioclase with just a very little bit of interstitial pyroxene. Very different than the anorthositic gabbros of the Duluth complex, which are more like 85% plag. Might not seem like a big difference, but to an igneous petrologist, they are. Sort of the whole putting this package together of these plagioclase-rich rocks, these normal rocks, and these very pure anorthosites, the model that we've kind of developed to explain all of these things have to do with the idea that we have this lower crustal chamber. We've used this lower crustal chamber to explain our felsic rocks. We can also use it to explain our plagioclase-rich rocks because plagioclase is a fairly low-density mineral, and near the upper crust, plagioclase is slightly more dense than the magma it crystallizes from. So it will sink to the bottom of the chamber just like all the other minerals that crystallize out of a mafic melt. But if you take that couplet and you put it in the base of the crust down in these lower subcrustal magma chambers around 40 kilometers, because a liquid is more compressible than a solid, plagioclase becomes less dense than the magmas it's crystallizing from. It should float. So the idea is in these lower crustal chambers, we're floating plagioclase. We're making pure anorthosite rock in the roof zones. We're making all the olivine and pyroxenes are sinking to the floor. We're making ultramafic rocks at the floor. When the main stage magmas first tapped these chambers, they basically took these mushes enriched in floating plagioclase up to the surface first and created the anorthositic intrusions that we see in the base of the complex. Once the conduits were flushed out, normal basaltic liquids followed behind them and emplaced themselves beneath the anorthositic rocks to create these layered series intrusions. Later on, when we intruded the Beaver Bay complex, it actually picked up wholesale inclusions of these pure plagioclase cumulus from the lower crust and brought them as blocks, as xenoliths, up in with the basaltic liquids. The largest of these blocks is at Carlton Peak. Probably many of you have been up to Carlton Peak. Nice quarry up there, a pure white rock. That block is a half a kilometer across. That means there was a crack in the Earth's crust a half a kilometer across from the base of the crust to the top of the crust. There's no doubt that that thing didn't stop when it got to kind of a kilometer of the surface. It erupted at the surface and probably created one of the largest lava flow eruptions in the whole rift. And in fact, we have a very large lava flow that we can trace from Isle Royal all the way to the Keweenaw Peninsula that's about 300 feet in thickness. It's called the Greenstone Flow. It's the same age as the Beaver River Diabase, and very likely they are contemporary or co-magmatic eruptions and intrusions. And again, one of the more accessible places to see one of these anorthosite blocks is at Split Rock. The lighthouse is built all on huge anorthosite inclusion. You can see some of the diabase of the Beaver River diabase, a little brownish rock here, mantling up against the anorthosite block. But right underneath the lighthouse, you can see some of the nature of this inclusion. But huge blocks. Okay, so that's kind of the big picture. Finally, I want to just talk a little bit about the copper-nickel deposits along the base of the Duluth complex. These have always, again, they've been known since the early 50s, late 40s actually was the early discovery. In the total compilation of the various ore deposits, they've really hung together to have a very consistent grade of about 0.6% copper, 0.2% nickel, and substantial shows of cobalt and precious metals. The fundamental origin of these things are the metals are provided by the mafic magmas, and the fact that these came from a plume. Plumes are notorious for being very metal rich, and so they're good prospective areas if you're going to look for base metal deposits, is to look for systems that were influenced by a mantle plume. So we start out with very metal rich magmas, but the great collector of metals is sulfur. Mafic magmas are notoriously poor in sulfur. So the way we get these two together is we have these very hot magmas encounter sulfur-bearing rocks. And in this situation, the sulfur-bearing rocks were largely the Virginia Formation, the black slates of the Virginia Formation that overlie the iron formations of the Boabic iron formation. And here's a cross-section through I think the water's a lot higher now from when this picture was taken, but you can see the iron formation and the Virginia Formation overlying it. You can see some stains from sulfide minerals, and then the Duluth complex irregularly cuts it. This whole sequence is tilted away from us as we view it, towards the Duluth complex to the east. And the mineralogy we see, again, the reality is that if it wasn't for the sulfide, there'd be no ore body here. Sulfur sulfides are the great collectors of metals. Copper, nickel, cobalt, if they had a choice between staying in a mafic magma and going in a sulfide liquid, they are many, many times more prone to go into the sulfide. And so what happens is the sulfide gets incorporated. There's only a certain carrying capacity of the mafic magma to hold sulfur in solution. Eventually it gets oversaturated and it unmixes from the mafic magma as a small droplet of sulfur, iron, and oxygen. A little sulfide bleb of immiscible liquid. That very dense liquid sort of settles through the mafic magma, and as it does, as it encounters ions of copper and nickel and cobalt, they partition themselves into these little droplets of sulfide as they rain down through the magma column. And this is the way by which those little droplets become enriched in metals. They accumulate on the floor, the base of the intrusion. And if they do it well enough and they encounter enough magma on the way down, they become ore grade. Kind of a very simplified model for some of these intrusions. We emplace the plagioclase crystal mushes first of the anorthositic series. Although we can't resolve the differences in ages between the anorthositic and the layered series, in the field you always see the anorthositic series as inclusions in the layered series. So they're telling us the first thing through the gate were these plagioclase-rich systems. So they come through for whatever reason. They weren't hot enough, they didn't have enough excess heat. They are themselves not very mineralized. You would think they're the first things through. They encountered the wall rocks that had the sulfur in it, but for whatever reason they did not pick up sulfur. But when the mafic magmas came in behind them and sheeted themselves between the anorthositic rocks and the foot wall that's carrying the sulfide, that maybe the role of the anorthositic series was to preheat the rocks. So by the time the layered series came in behind it, it was ready and primed to devolatilize the footwall of its sulfur and allow it to be incorporated into these sheets. And each time a new pulse came in, it would basically churn up the sulfide, especially what's in the feeder zone here, and reincorporate it and high-grade that sulfide with new fresh melt that's got new metals in it and could high-grade the sulfide, especially in this ore zone. And this is one of the things that in all the exploration, the ideal thing, we're now, here's the cross section, we're actually looking at deposits that we think are somewhat distal from the main feeder zone. Although there's some evidence that there is some sort of at least secondary feeders that are feeding some of these areas too. But if we could find this actual neck, the conduit, the main source coming through, we would be seeing a huge ore body. But it might be too deep. It might be, you know, many kilometers deep, and we're just not going to get to it. But we don't know yet. We haven't fully explored it. One last thing to mention, too, is Dean Peterson had done a lot of work in the South Kuishui intrusion mineralization, and he identified two styles of mineralization, one he called open, one he called confined. And I'll just kind of go through and describe what that is. Here's an example of open style, and it's basically hundreds of meters of mineralization at relatively low grade, and it's very irregular. It comes and it goes, but there's no real trend to it, and it's overall rather low grade, but very thick and extensive. Confined style is very tight to the footwall, and you can see that the grade actually gets better as you go higher up, and probably the best grade is at the very top of the mineralized section at the base of the intrusion. So these are two different styles, and these seem to be the most prospective. This is, I think, where the Franconia deposit has this kind of a style. The Duluth Metals deposit has this type of style as well. And what is thought to be, again, what high grades the metal is each little droplet of sulfide, the more mafic magma it sees, the more it collects metals. And so if you bring it into a turbulent system and you take this aspirated sulfide droplets and you roll them through the silicate melt and expose them to a lot of silicate melt, it just keeps high-grading and high-grading the sulfide. And so this confined system is thought to have resulted from very turbulent flow underneath areas where the north acidic overhanging material was confining the flow. And so you had these turbulent flows. This is good. This is more water, right? This is kind of flow. So this is more appropriate here. But you're basically you're creating turbulent flow as opposed to in open chambers. It becomes more static. There's not a lot of opportunity for the sulfide to encounter the silicate melt. So that's Dean's main argument for these. So I'll just these are the current companies. Ernie's going to talk more about this, but these various areas of high enough concentration that we call them potential deposits are shown here with the companies that are involved. And I'll just leave you with this. This is a graph that was put together by Ekstrand and Hulbert in a Canadian journal in 2007 that basically compared the Duluth complex with a lot of other what we call mafic sulfide or magmatic sulfide deposits. What's shown here is the percent of nickel in the ore material and then the total tonnage of ore. These bars are telling us the actual contained metal in the deposits. And when it comes to nickel, the Duluth complex ranks just behind Sudbury in Norilsk, where probably two-thirds of the world's nickel comes from. The Duluth complex, although low grade, has an incredible amount of contained nickel. This is 10 million, is that tons or pounds? Tons. In copper, it is number one for magmatic sulfide deposits. There are larger deposits of porphyry copper systems in the world, but for magmatic sulfide deposits, the Duluth complex ranks number one. These are world-class. This is the largest undeveloped ore body on Earth that someday will be mined. So I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
I think we might have time for one question.
In terms, I guess I'm not sure which timing you're talking. In the early gabbros? Yeah, I mean those early intrusions up along the Gunflint Trail, the bases of those are mineralized. There's copper nickel mineralization in the base of the Poplar Lake intrusion and the Cucumber Lake intrusion. But they're in the boundary waters and the grade there is really not very good. But they are mineralized, to be sure.
Before we move on to the next speaker, I just want to put a plug in. You know, if terms like troctolitic anorthosite or leucogabbros kind of stir latent interest in igneous petrology and economic geology, and in particular, in general, the geology in northeast Minnesota, the Lake Superior Institute of Lake Superior Geology is meeting later this month, and I think there's some field trips, so you might want to check those out.